Welcome to episode 3 of the Serious About Security podcast for March 16th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SERIAS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson. I'm a research engineer at SERIAS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP.
So for announcements this week, and as we have in the previous podcast, we've talked about the upcoming SERIAS Annual Information Security Symposium. This year will be April 3rd and 4th, and it will be on the campus of Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. It will be hosted at the Lawson Computer Science Building. We have an interesting set of speakers on tap this year. On April 3rd, Arthur Cavillo Jr., the chairman of RSA, the security division of EMC, will be our opening keynote speaker. Then on the 4th, Howard Schmidt, the special assistant to the president and senior director for cybersecurity in the office of the U.S. president, will give another keynote address. Also on the 4th, the annual Information Security Symposium is an opportunity for students here at SERIAS to highlight and discuss their research projects with the attendees and sponsors of SERIAS. There'll be a Tech Talk poster preview in which students present their research projects in less than 60 seconds. Immediately following the preview, there'll be an opportunity to meet the students and discuss their projects in the poster session. Also, we'll be having panel discussions on big data analytics, mobile device security, and SCADA system security, and we'll feature views from academic, government, and industry experts. For more information on the speakers and topics, and to register for the symposium, please visit www.cerias.purdue.edu. And the registration page went live fairly recently, so please register. SERIAS also hosts a weekly security seminar series. And it is a computer science class that we've been hosting this since 1992. It's broadcast locally in the Greater Lafayette area, live. And later, we also post those videos as podcast. On March 21st, Randall Brooks from Raytheon, a SERIAS sponsor, will talk about adding a software assurance dimension to supply chain practices. On March 28th, Nabil Muhammad here at Purdue will speak. On April 4th, J.R. Rao from IBM Research will be here not only for the symposium, but also to speak at the seminar. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, please see the SERIAS website and click on the seminars link at the top of the page.
The March Greater Lafayette Security Professionals meeting was held on the 8th. Our speaker was Matt Yonkman from Emerging Threats Pro. Matt spoke about his work with Emerging Threats, the Open Information Security Foundation, Cerakata, and many other interesting projects. The April meeting is set for the 12th. Currently, Lou Ann Keaton from the Purdue Regional Extension Center will speak about the ISACA organization and the CRIS certification. She was awarded this certification back in January. We also have room on the schedule for another speaker. Please contact Keith Watson or Preston Wiley if you're interested.
In news today, Apple iOS released a version 5.2 on March 7th, which fixes vulnerabilities in Mobile Safari and other subsystems. Apple Safari web browser for Windows Lion and Snow Leopard was updated to version 5.1.4 on March 12th, which fixes 83 vulnerabilities. And since our last podcast, Google released two separate updates to the Chrome web browser to fix a number of issues, and two of these issues qualified for a $60,000 reward from Google, which we will talk about in our articles today. And on March 13th, Microsoft released six security bulletins along with updates. One of them was critical and four important, and the critical one is of a special note, and that Microsoft recommended that users immediately apply the update. It was a update to remote desktop, which allowed for login to remote desktop without authentication if the network layer security was not enabled.
So in the previous podcast, we discussed Chrome extensively and talked about two aspects at the CANSEC West conference. There was the Pwn to Own vulnerability contest, which is sponsored by HP Tipping Point, and they had there was a separate contest that Google Chrome held called Ponium. And the discussion we had last time focused around the contest that Google was hosting due to a change in the rules to pwn to own, which allowed the participants to not have to reveal the details of their exploit. And obviously Chrome is looking to improve the security of their own product, and that rule really doesn't help them do that. So they hosted their own contest, and but separate from that was the pwn to own contest. Now, Chrome was still in play for that contest, and in fact, within the first 5 minutes of that, one of the teams was able to launch a vulnerability against Chrome and demonstrate a vulnerability that was pretty significant, even with the Chrome sandbox. So what was interesting was that last year, Chrome was not compromised during pwn to own. And this year, the security outfit that did that, the name of which is VuePen, I believe, it's a French security group, was able to do that within the first 5 minutes of the contest. Now, they also demonstrated some other flaws in Safari as well, so they were certainly not just focused on Chrome. The interesting thing is that this was done outside of the Google-sponsored contest and was one of the first ones compromised, one of the first browsers compromised in the pwn-to-own contest. So the interesting thing is the prizes awarded to this team was $60,000. And if you look at the prizes awarded to the vulnerabilities demonstrated in the other contests, they're roughly the same. So I found that pretty interesting. And I just thought I'd mention that since we discussed it last week about the contest, and this is the actual results from the contest.
Yeah, I think it was interesting that, researchers really had two different contests they could pick from to exploit Chrome in, whether it was the pwn to own or Google's Ponium. And looking through the articles for today's podcast, it was kind of difficult to decipher whether a researcher could enter both. It appears that you could do one or the other. And as you mentioned, one researcher did it for the pwn to own and did it within the first 5 minutes, I think, to demonstrate that that Google Chrome could be hacked, even though it had not been hacked before. In Google's own Ponium contest, I know that two additional exploits occurred there as well. And that the first one was from a Russian security researcher by the name of Sergey Glazunov. I probably did not pronounce his last name correctly there. But what I find interesting is he's really helped expose exploits before. It sounds like he's a security researcher who's helped Chrome really improve over the years. So he was able to, execute remote code vulnerability and was awarded the $60,000 prize. The other exploit I found just as interesting was a user only by the name of Pinkie Pie as their handle was also able to uncover an exploit under the Ponium contest. And apparently this was done by a teenager. So I find it interesting that the range of experience there. I believe the security researcher from Russia has a great deal of experience and kind of works in this realm, which made him kind of an obvious choice. But I find it interesting that a teenager was also able to find an exploit. And just kind of reading through some things, I know some of the arguments behind that was, you don't necessarily have to have a lot of experience to be able to hack into these kinds of things. Being younger and not having the kind of experience allows you to maybe think outside the box a little better.
I would definitely agree with that. Typically, some people who do not have the biases or preconceived notions about how security works in applications come in with some amount of advantage because they think, like you said, out of the box and can find new and interesting ways to exploit vulnerabilities.
Well, what I find interesting is the ViewPen co-founder and head of research was quoted as saying, last year we saw a lot of headlines that no one could hack Chrome, and we wanted to make sure it was the first to fall this year. So there were a lot of people touting last year that Chrome is unbreakable. You know, Chrome can be broken. And so they made it their mission, and it looks like other people somewhat made it their mission to kind of make sure it didn't happen again this year. So it fell within the first 5 minutes of the Pwn, because probably last year it didn't fall at all.
If I remember right, last year I'm not sure anybody even attempted exploits against it. Maybe incorrect on that, but I seem to recall that being a big spotlight being mentioned in last year's contest. But what else is also interesting is I've lost my thought.
Well, you don't break something in 5 minutes. I mean, you know, these people prepared for this. So I'm guessing people prepared for it last year as well. And the fact that nobody attempted it doesn't mean they didn't attempt it outside the contest. You know, they may have attempted it and failed last year. So
that's certainly true. But what else is also interesting is that Google itself, by setting up its Pwnium contest, wanted to dispel the myth of having a super secure browser by doing their own contest, in a sense. Because there's always a risk if you're a vendor to say, yeah, our stuff's unbreakable. People feel challenged then to go prove you wrong. So to avoid that, the Chrome team said, well, we'll do our own contest, and yeah, we're likely to get exploited. But that's okay, because we can turn that around into fixes and get them out quickly, which is what they did. Now, if you recall from many years ago, Oracle did something similar with their products, calling them unbreakable, which then prompted a month of exploits against Oracle products, and pretty much they released an exploit every day during the month in which they did that. So that's a marketing ploy that rarely works, but I think Google kind of took lessons from Oracle's goof and said, hey, we know we're not perfect. People may think we are, but we need to prove the security of our platform by allowing people to attack it and rewarding them for it, as long as they share that information with us.
Yeah, I think you both make some really good points there. From a marketing perspective, you really want to kind of advertise the advantages of it, of, you know, the fact that your software is more secure. I think ultimately Google wants to promote that their browser is the most secure. But I think they also recognize anything can be broken with enough effort by someone. You know, I don't think they're touting that it's perfect. And what's really interesting about, you know, the fact that they were willing to put money up and say, you know, target us specifically, I think really was what made the difference here, was people knew that they could get a big payday if they went after Chrome. I think your statement earlier, Keith, about they weren't targeted last year, I believe that's accurate from what I read last week in preparation, was that they weren't targeted primarily because they used the sandbox approach. So inherently, it's just more difficult to get an exploit, because even if you find an exploit in Chrome, that wasn't enough to earn the prize. You had to make that exploit break out of the sandbox in order to get the reward. So as a hacker approaching these things, it's just easier to go after one of the other browsers because they don't have the sandbox approach in place. So it might be a little easier. But then by not being targeted last year, people saying, well, Chrome's unbreakable or it's unhackable, I think we saw that a bunch of people rose up and said, well, that's not true. We just need to put a little more effort into it and we can find a way to break it.
Okay, the next article we have is the U.S. Army warns about the risks of geotagging. The article talks about a U.S. Army helicopter that flew over a base in Iraq, and soldiers took photos using their phones, I guess, and uploaded them to a website. And the geotagging information on the photos was used to locate the helicopter and shoot it down with mortars.
Well, I believe that they targeted the helicopters that were parked on the flight line in the base with the mortars. So that's how they didn't shoot. You can't shoot something down easily with a mortar, but when they're on the ground, you can target them. I believe that's what they did.
So they attacked the base using the helicopter because they were in a U.S. military base. So they targeted the U.S. military base because a helicopter within the U.S. military base took a picture of the base, uploaded it, and they targeted the base with mortars, destroying four helicopters. Okay. And those helicopters are worth how much?
I looked it up on Wikipedia, the source of all accurate information, and it said $20 million.
So destroying four helicopters worth $20 million apiece, so $80 million for uploading a photo.
And no mention of whether soldiers were or civilians were injured or killed in that as well. I found that interesting. Just a loss of equipment.
Well, I think this article is just an extreme example on why geotagging is a dangerous thing. Again, it didn't point out that any life was lost, but $80 million worth of damage is pretty significant in and of itself. And if anybody lost their life due to it, that's horrible. So, I mean, this is the U.S. Army talking, but I think even in day-to-day life, posting a photo with geotagging information, unless you realize what's going on, can be a bad idea.
And I think one of the problems is kind of the transparency of using your phone for these things. A lot of these features, I think, are just enabled by default. You know, so I'll admit it. I pulled out my smartphone after reading the article, and I'm like, gee, do I have geotagging on for my camera? And in that case, I did not. But you know, I was looking at the other services that I use, where I do allow my location to be known. You know, and consider that. You know, I think for the average user, it's just a phone, and you're not necessarily thinking about it. And that's the part that I find, I guess, a bit disturbing about all of it is, you know, I think soldiers fighting in a war, I mean, I think, you know, they're very, you know, they do a great service to our country in defending our freedom. I'm not sure that that all of them are necessarily going to understand when they take a picture that there's, you know, latitude and longitude behind it, that their specific location can be known just from that picture. Furthermore, depending on where they're uploading those pictures to, even if you have geotagging disabled, I believe there are some sites where you upload your photos where it can sort of still roughly determine the location just based on what's in that picture or where you were when you uploaded it, the wireless network you were on or the cellular towers that you were using when you uploaded that photo. So even if, you know, even if you're, I guess, a more security aware user and you say, well, I'd never use geotagging on my photos, but I'm using this website to upload my data. If it's triangulating your Wi-Fi signals and your cellular towers, it may be just adding that on behind the scenes and still providing access to your location that you do not want.
Yeah, location services, anytime you enable that on a mobile device, there's lots of services that can consume that. And usually when you run it, you'll get a little notice pop up and says, this application wants to know your location. And you can either allow or not allow. And some people will say, well, yeah, I need to send that out. People need to know where I'm at, so they'll click allow. And then it might be on by default for the rest of the time they use their phone. So it's an awareness issue. And I think that was the point of the army.mil site article, was to say, look, guys, here's a situation where we lost equipment. Don't know if anybody was injured. We hope not. But the operational security of the mission needs to be considered, and your phone is compromising that mission. and keep that in mind. And so I think the British military banned the use of smartphones in war zones for this specific reason. And so some of what I do is work on security awareness through the Facebook security guide, for example. And so I do, for purposes of understanding how these services work, I do leave a lot of the location services on so that I can experience what an average user might have with location services that enabled. And I got to say, it's compelling. You get a lot of cool stuff to work, like Foursquare and even web browser searches where this browser knows where you are can give you local information, right? But there's the cautionary tale here that one thing that people do with Foursquare, for example, is they'll check in at their own house. And if you think about that, you're publishing where your house is. And when you're not at home, and so just having that information available to somebody who might want to rob your house, especially if you take pictures of all the rich stuff you have in your house, might be motivation for somebody to go and track you online and visit your home when you're not there. So my purpose in having this is more I need to know what's available, how this works, so that I can write information so that people can be aware of that. So I'm kind of skating the border here to say, well, here's the issues, and yet I'm worried about the risks as well, and try to balance that so I can relay that information in awareness documents. But I think a lot of people see the wow factor and the cool factor outweighing the risks that they've not considered, and so that's certainly something that this article hopes to point out, I think, not only for troops in situations, but also the spouses of soldiers posting information about where their loved one is at, for example, and then maybe sharing photos that were sent to them, not necessarily through a service, but sharing them with their friends. And that all those photos have enough metadata in them to track somebody down.
I'm glad you brought up Facebook, because one of my favorite quotes out of the article mentioned Facebook's new timeline feature. And basically, the guy who wrote the article suggested that Facebook's new timeline is basically a dummy's guide to stalking. And I've looked at, I've used that a little bit, and it's really interesting because there are a few things. Like you, I like to experiment around with the location services, and I've checked in a few locations. Fortunately, not at home, but, places I've visited. And with the new timeline, it's very interesting because you can just, get a roadmap of patterns. I mean, it's not difficult to figure out, my friend is going to this restaurant every Thursday between 12 and 2, And the word friend on Facebook is really interesting as well. I have very few friends, so I guess I'm just kind of a sad, lonely person since I don't have many friends, versus others I know who have hundreds and hundreds or even thousands of friends. That's just something really interesting to consider. If those thousands of friends can see where you've been, what you're doing, they can learn a lot from that information, like when you'll be home and when you won't.
Yeah, and that's going back to the military terminology, that's a traffic analysis. I figure out where you go, what your pattern is, and I can determine things that are out of sequence, out of pattern, and people can follow you based on that. And now it's all centralized. It makes it easy to do. So anyways, I think these risks that people have not considered are the bigger issue. And just as we've seen concerns about mobile applications uploading contact databases, this is a similar issue, that there's a transparency gap. People are not always aware that these services are putting their information at risk. Now, in the case of a lot of mobile applications, people still want to have that ability, and they're willing to trade off some amount of privacy to get it. And so as long as vendors and device designers and application developers are open with how they use that information and allow users to opt out when possible, to go back and clean up their history, if you will. We can still have these services with cool features, but we need to have a limit on it, and we need to be aware of what they're doing.
Okay. Well, we'll wrap this up. Thanks to Keith Watson and Mike Hill for hosting the show, as well as Sirius. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.